Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be in Esther chapter 5 through 7 today, which deals with Esther's plans for rescuing herself and her people that we talked about last week in chapter 4 as Mordecai came to her and said, Esther, you're going to have to do something. God brought you to a place like this. You want to escape yourself. If the Jews die, you'll die. And how do you know God didn't bring you to a place of royalty just for this moment? And so out of that context of the providence of God, the faith in God, Esther has them make a 3-day fast. She's going to fast with her maidens in the harem, and Mordecai is to gather the Jews of Susa and there to fast and pray. Now chapter 5 through 7 tells the unfolding story of how Esther, after this 40-hour fast, how she proceeds. Now, in here, she's going to kind of... We're not sure of the motivation behind why she's going to do what she does. And if we could, we'd understand better the personality of Esther. She seems to be rather shy and rather reluctant in what she's having to do. Not scheming, but simply reluctant. Now, notice what happens in 5:1. Now, it came about on the third day that Esther put on her royal robes. Now, some have said, well, she took off her sackcloth and ashes and put on the royal robes. I'm not sure she had sackcloth and ashes in the harem. I think what she's doing is she is getting herself as pretty as she can be, putting her best foot forward so when that king sees her, he's going to be moved with pity, compassion, love, whatever. So here she's dressed in all the regalia of the queen of Persia. And notice what she does. She stood in the inner court of the king's palace in front of the king's room, and the king was sitting on his royal throne in the throne room opposite the entrance of the palace. That seems rather unusual in English. It seems very detailed. But you know, we have found from archaeological excavations of Susa or Shushan, same thing, two different names, that this is very, very accurate. The pillared hall is what this is talking about. And this just fits exactly where the throne was and the inner court and all that. It is obvious that the author of Esther is an eyewitness to what's happening or someone who was very, very familiar with the workings and the architecture of the inner life of the Persian court. Now, and it happened when the king saw Esther the queen standing in the court, she obtained favor in his sight, and the king extended to Esther the golden scepter. Now, this was the sign that she would not be killed. Apparently, this was the custom for someone unannounced coming in the king's presence. And remember, we've talked about it before. The only ones who could come in his presence unannounced were members of the 7 royal families that helped him overthrow Gotama, the Egyptian usurper. And these 7 families could come into his presence any time. But anybody else, on pain of death, unless the scepter was held out to them, even members of his own family. Now, notice where it mentions them. So Esther came near and touched the top of the scepter. The king said to her, "What is troubling you, Queen Esther? And what is your request? Even the half of my kingdom, it will be given you." Well, it was obvious to the king that by risking her life, something was very, very bad. She was willing to put her life on the line. He said, "Honey, what is the problem?" Now, this "even the half of my kingdom," this is kind of an Oriental idiom. Now, we know from history that one of Xerxes I's wives took this literally and asked for a special cape that had been made by the wife we know of history, Amytris. And boy, Xerxes tried everything in the world to get her to make another request, and that she wouldn't. So this got him in trouble, as we learned from the Gospel of Mark, chapter 6, verse 23, when Herod did this and John the Baptist's head fell. But it really is a metaphor saying, you found favor in my sight, whatever you want, I'll give you. Now, and Esther said, "If it please the king, may the king and Haman come this day to the banquet I have prepared for him." Now, this verse 4 is a little unusual. In some of the medieval manuscripts, the first 4 words and the first consonant of every word is kind of accentuated to show that the first letters of these 4 words are YHWH, which is, of course, the covenant name for God. But that seems just to be a coincidence and not something that the author of Esther had in mind, okay? So, it is unusual for Haman to be invited to the banquet with the king, and he took it as a great honor, but there was other purposes behind this. Some say the queen did it to make him jealous, but I don't think we can get that from the Masoretic text. And the king said, "Bring Haman quickly, that we may do as Esther desires." So the king and Haman came to the banquet which Esther had prepared, apparently in the harem. Okay? And as they drank their wine at the banquet, the king said to Esther, "What is your petition? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even the half of my kingdom it shall be done." And Esther answered and said, "My petition and my request is..." And it's almost like a broken sentence here. She almost got it out, but she chickened out at the last minute, is what the text seems to imply. And she said, and it's in court etiquette, "Oh, if I found favor with you, and if it pleased you, come back tomorrow." So she, I think she's just timid. I don't know what other explanation we can put here. Maybe she's trying to pique his interest and gain his sympathy. I don't know. Make him jealous with Haman. We're just not sure, but it seems she's just nervous. Verse 9. "Then Haman went out that day glad and pleased of heart. And when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate..." Notice again and again, Mordecai is connected with the king's gate. In chapter 10, verse 6, it seems to be official position. "And he did not stand up nor tremble before him, and Haman was filled with anger against Mordecai." Well, since Mordecai had heard about the decree and what Haman was trying to do to all Jews, not only would he not bow down — that was the problem back in chapter 3, he wouldn't bow down or prostrate himself — now he won't even recognize Haman's presence. He didn't stand up, he didn't acknowledge him, he just ignored him. And oh, friends, being ignored is worse than being hated, I guess. And Haman just went berserk. Haman controlled himself, however. He went to his house and sent for his friends and for his wife. Now, his friends are apparently these counselors, these magicians, these magi who had cast the lots for him earlier. Maybe he has 10 sons. Maybe his sons were involved and all of that. Maybe some high court officials. And his wife, first mentioned here, we don't know what the name means. The etymology is uncertain. "Then Haman recounted to them all the good things that the king had done for him, how he had been blessed monetarily and blessed positionally, and how he had such authority and everybody bowed down. He went through all the things that should have made him a happy, content man. But look what happened. Boy, it didn't do it. He even mentions Esther invited only him to the banquet with the king. And look at verse 13. "Yet all of this does not satisfy me every time I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate." Boy, I want to tell you, anger, bitterness, hatred, pride, jealousy are cruel taskmasters. Haman had everything, but this root of bitterness destroyed his joy. You know what? When this happens in us, and it happens in Christians, it'll just ruin everything God's trying to do in your life. And you know what? This hatred of Haman opened into hurt Mordecai. It destroyed Haman. Hate will always destroy the person who's feeling and letting vent to that emotion. Had everything. And this one little thing bothered him so bad he couldn't find peace and happiness and contentment. And then Zereth, his wife, and all his friends said to him, "Have a gallows of 50 cubits high made, and in the morning ask the king for Mordecai to have hanged on it." Now, this gallows is very unusual. It's 50 cubits high. Now, a cubit is the distance from a man's longest finger to his elbow. It varies some. There's a more standardized one, about 18 inches. There is an official building cubit, about 20 inches, that we find in Egypt and in Israel in the temple like Solomon. Now, so you multiply 18 times 50 and you get the about 75 feet, 60 to 75 feet, something like that. Now, when I say the word gallows and the word hanged, I think of someone being hanged by a rope around the neck, kind of like we see in the Western movies or something. But this really is the idea of being impaled, not hung by the neck. They didn't even know that kind of form of death. But they would impale a man. So this, some say this shows it's not historical, a 50-foot pole. Well, we're not sure if it was on top of something or how they got the 50 cubits or if they had some big pine trees like they do in East Texas. I don't know, but they wanted to, the reason for it being so tall is that Mordecai would be publicly shamed and a larger group of people could see it because he was higher up. may even built it in the courtyard of Haman the prime minister. Now this impaling was done in Israel, and we see it, an allusion to it, in Deuteronomy 21:23, where it says, "Cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree." Now the idea is that someone would be killed, and then they would be publicly exposed by impaling them for a period of time of public display. And that's what's talked about here, impaling, not hanging. And the advice, please Haman, real nice wife. She just said, "You're going to get him anyway, hon, don't worry." Nice lady. By the way, I want to mention this impaling a couple of places if you'll write these down. Chapter 9, verse 13 talks about this. Also in Herodotus, 3:159 and 4:43 deal with this impaling. And then the Behistun inscription, column number 2, paragraphs 13 and 14, and column number 3, paragraph 8, deal with this public impaling. Look at verse 6. During the night, the king could not sleep. Does this mean that God is involved even in heartburn? I think what happened, the guy ate too much the night before, and he had indigestion and couldn't sleep. But apparently God was involved with it. So here we have God keeping the king up. So he gave order to bring the book of the record. And that's mentioned back in chapter 2:23. And that's where Mordecai's deed of saving the king's life from this conspiracy of the eunuchs who guard his personal house was recorded. It's mentioned again in chapter 10, verse 2, this book of Chronicles. And it was found written that Mordecai had reported concerning Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who were doorkeepers, and they had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And the king said, "What honor or dignity has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" And the king's servants who attend him said, "Nothing has been done." Oh, that was great shame. You see, the king gave these favors to people who helped him, and it was really a requirement. It was just a must, and somehow it got overlooked in the bureaucracy of the palace. And so notice what happened. So the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now, the court would be the outer chamber away from the throne room. If a king wanted somebody, he would call out there and say, "Send so-and-so in." They said, "But who is the attendant?" Now, these attendants were on duty 24 hours a day. When the king wanted something, there was somebody there. Haman had come very, very early in the morning. Most Oriental monarchs had court very early because it was cool. And Haman wanted to get Mordecai killed quick, so he came early in the morning, and he was out there waiting to be called before the king. And so Haman's out there, and they called Haman. The king said to him, "What is to be done for the man whom the king desires to honor?" And Haman said to himself, "Whom would the king desire to honor more than me?" Oh, boy, does pride mess things up. King asked him a question. Haman said, "Oh, this must be talking about me. He wants to bless me. So I'm going to really make it good so I can really be blessed." That's not what he said. And Haman said to the king, "For the man whom the king desires to honor, three basic things, really four. Number one, let them bring the royal robe which the king has worn." Now, this wearing of royal robes was, in a sense, taking on some of the royalty of the king. Now, it's hard for us to realize, but touching the king, wearing the king's clothes, riding the king's horse, sitting in the king's chair, some of the royalty kind of rubbed off on you, and you became really special. And that's the idea here. "And the horse on which the king has ridden," not just one he owns, but one he has ridden, the official royal stud. You see, it's mentioned in chapter 8, verse 10. "And on whose head a royal crown has been placed." Well, there's been much discussion about this. Some wonder, does this refer to the king? Because obviously the royal crown wouldn't be put on a subject, no matter how high that subject was. Well, some say because of the reliefs from the city of Susa, that it refers to a special royal headdress that the king's horse wore. And that seems to be the context here. And then number 9, verse 9. "And let the robe and the horse be handed over to the one of the king's most noble princes, and let them array the man." Notice the king has to dress him. And let the prince has to dress this special man to be honored, "whom the king desires to honor, and lead him on horseback through the city square," the place of public prominence, "and proclaim before him, 'Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor.'" Well, boy, Haman thought, "I'll really get some recognition today." And look what happens. Oh, what the irony of this. "And the king said to Haman, 'Take quickly the robes and the horse, as you have said, and do so for Mordecai the Jew, who is sitting at the king's gate.'" and do not fall short in anything of all that you have said. Don't you know this guy's Adam's apple rose up into his throat where he couldn't breathe? Of all the people to do this to, if it wasn't going to be him, oh, not Mordecai the Jew. Now, notice it mentions Mordecai the Jew. How did they know he was a Jew? Well, it must have been recorded in these chronicles that they read just the night before. Now, whether King Ahasuerus had made an understanding between the edict of Haman earlier and Mordecai being a Jew is not certain. Now, it says, sitting at the gate. This seems to be an official position. Whether he was a controller of the gate or a keeper of the gate or official guard or whatever, he's always connected with the king's palace at the gate. And so I think that's where his job was. So Haman took the robe and the horse and arrayed Mordecai and led him on horseback personally through the city square and proclaimed before him, "Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor." Oh, croak. And the king returned. Mordecai returned to the king's gate, back to his job. But Haman hurried home, mourning with his head covered. I bet he was. We have two precedents of this. David, one time doing this, 2 Samuel 15:30. And a possible allusion to this in Psalms 44:15. You might want to look at covering the head as a sign of shame. And Haman recounted to Zereth, his wife, and all his friends, everything that happened to him. Then his wise men, that's those ones apparently in chapter 3:7, who cast the lots. Now, these wise men are mentioned quite often in Herodotus, where we learn mostly about them. Herodotus, chapter 1, section 107 and section 120, and Herodotus, chapter 7, section 19. Now, there's a very strange little thing here that his wife says, and no one is able to explain verse 13. This is what she says. "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish origin, you will not overcome him, but he will surely fall before him." My goodness, what is that talking about? Is she playing the prophetess? Well, it's very similar to what Pontius Pilate's wife said to him during Jesus' trial. It seems to be that the author is putting a prophetic message in the mouth of these wives. Now, whether they understood what they were saying or it has another meaning, we're just not certain. And while they were talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hastily brought Haman to the banquet. This was common for a special guest to be escorted to the banquet. Haman probably forgot about this banquet. It may have lifted his spirits, but he'll say, well, at least I get to go to the banquet. Mordecai doesn't. So here's chapter 7, the final intrigue, okay, of Haman's due. "Now the king and Haman came to drink wine with Esther the queen. And the queen said to Esther on the second day also, as they drank their wine at the banquet." And these Persians were known for their drinking bouts. "What is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you. And what is your request? Even to half the kingdom it shall be done." Well, the queen couldn't be put it off anymore. "And the queen Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight..." This is that polite... this is probably what they trained him a whole year to do, is use this polite court etiquette. "And if it please the king, let my life be given to me as my petition, and my people as my request." Boy, the king must have thought, what? "For we have been sold..." Now, this may refer to the 10,000 talents of silver that Haman offered to pay. "I and my people to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated." The same sequence of three parallel words that were in Haman's edict, okay? "And if we had only been sold as slaves, men and women, I would have remained silent, for the trouble would not have been commensurate with the annoyance of the king." Here's again, he just said, "I wouldn't have bothered you, hun, if it had been some little thing," like all going to slavery. "And King Ahasuerus asked Queen Esther, who is he and where is he who would presume to do this?" Boy, now he probably has an idea, but he either wants Esther to say it plainly or he hasn't caught on what's happening yet. "And Esther said, a foe, an enemy, is this wicked Haman." Notice the intensification. The word a foe, enemy, and wicked are very strong Hebrew terms. "And then Haman became terrified before the king and queen. And the king arose in his anger from drinking wine." This either says that the alcohol had accentuated his emotions. He was so angry he just burst out of the room. Or it was some kind of official sign of displeasure and judgment that was coming. But he left the room to think a minute in the palace garden. "But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm had been determined against him. Now when the king returned from the palace garden into the place where they were drinking, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was." Well, now Esther had obtained royalty by being close to the king. And apparently she was reclining with her feet behind her. And Haman had apparently grabbed her feet or was even possibly kissing her feet as a sign of obeisance. Well, man, if Esther was trying to make the king jealous, this set the thing off. And even if he wasn't, for the king to see him doing that to his young queen, his favorite one, whether he was mad over the document about the Jews, he was certainly mad over this ceremonial violation of his queen. Boy, he was angry. And the king said, "Will he even assault the queen with me in the house?" As the word went out from the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Now, this covering of the face seems to be involved with someone who is being prepared for execution. There's two theories that the ancients talk about. One is the man doesn't deserve to see the king's face anymore. And the other one is cover his face so he won't put the evil eye on the king. Now, whether it is, I'm not real sure. This practice is common in both Greek and Roman literature, but it's unknown except here in Persian literature. Now, in verse 9, the irony of verse 9 and 10 is striking. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs who was before the king, said, "Behold, indeed, the gallows." Now, that really should be changed to impaling stick. It's possible it even refers to crucifixion, though that primarily is a Phoenician capital punishment taken up by the Romans. This seems to be impaling, not gallows, standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high. Prominent. Haman is going to be impaled on the very gallows he had built for Mordecai, right in his own courtyard, and the height to embarrass Mordecai would now expose his own body, which Haman made for Mordecai, and who spoke good on behalf of the king. Now, this refers to Mordecai's, and of course Esther did it, but she did it in Mordecai's name, of overhearing this plot to assassinate the king and informing him, and that's what it means, who spoke good on behalf of the king. And the king said, "Hang him on it." Now, again, we must understand hanging as impaling, not as a rope around the neck. So they hanged Haman on the gallows, impaled him on the stake, which he had prepared for Mordecai, and the king's anger subsided. The king does seem to have these fits of anger, and they're often connected with him drinking too much. That's what happened with Vashti. That's what happened here. Maybe the queen wanted to invite him to a banquet because she knew he was a high-strung guy and tend to overreact after he had drank too much. And maybe that's why she invited him, just to get him a little crocked. We don't know if Esther was really manipulating jealousy and the alcohol and the scene. We just don't know if that's the case or if she was just timid. But I want to tell you, you talk about irony. The plot has thickened to the point that you just can't believe what's happened. Even the man's own wife, in the midst of his problems, gives a prophecy on behalf of Mordecai. The night before the second banquet, God causes the king heartburn, and he reads these documents that tell of Mordecai the Jew at the gate who had never been rewarded. Now, I know the book of Esther does not have the name of God, neither Yahweh, nor Elohim, nor El Shaddai, nor Adon, nor Adonai, none of them, or even allusions to it. But friend, God is present in this book. He's present in every aspect of protecting the Jews and setting the stage. And it's just a marvelous work of the providence of God in protecting His people in a foreign land. And it's just amazing here. I wish we had more information. This period of Persian history, until we were able to interpret the cuneiform tablets, no one could read them. And the only history we had was the history of Herodotus and Plutarch. And we found them to be pretty accurate, but now we have, many, many documents, both from the Persian period and the Babylonian period and the Assyrian period. And it's really helped to fill in some of the gaps. But the problem is, when these people wrote histories, they wrote it in an exaggerated form. It was always complimentary to them, and it was always an overstatement of numbers and the victories and this and that. And we don't know much of the simple court life, the everyday life. We know about the big battles and the kings and the coronations, but nothing about the daily procedures or the way people did things day by day. And that's why there's such a tremendous gap here. I think if you can possibly get Herodotus, it would really set the stage for all of this Persian period and would really set the stage for the coming of Christ, because the wise men, the magi, in Matthew chapter 2 are the same kind of wise men that apparently cast these lots and that Herodotus mentions so much. And so it would be very, very helpful. Again, I think as I read this, I see it not as a literary technique to back up where Purim came from, but it seems to me to be obvious history. We've got a man who knows the working of the court, the procedures, the handing out of the golden scepter, and all of that. He knows how many counselors there are. There's 7 counselors who can come. He's familiar with the architecture of inside the palace at Susa in the very period. So to me, even though there is some things that are hard, the 180 days of chapter 1, the stake 75 feet tall, that is difficult to explain historically, but not totally impossible. And I think to me it just says this is a history. This is an actual account. This is not a made-up technique to back up the Jews turning a Babylonian feast into a Jewish feast, but it actually is the historical origin of the Feast of Purim, which means, an Akkadian word, for the casting of lots. It refers to the casting of Haman's lots, who was to destroy the Jews. But ultimately, the casting of lots was for the Jews to rid themselves of their enemies. And we see the hand of God working step by step throughout this in a silent, behind-the-scenes way. Well, next week we'll finish the book of Esther. I hope you've read through it completely. I've really enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again, same time, same place, next week. God bless you.